Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome. Well, I'm going to go ahead and bring on my first guest straight away because we're a little late starting today. We're looking today at something that every single one of you is going to face at some point. At the end of your life. It is greening death. And Suzanne Kelly reveals what many call the funeral industry's environmentally destructive methods. She'll share insights into greening alternatives that restore our tie to the earth. So it's kind of an interesting topic about, you know, what made somebody so interested in this that they wrote a whole book about it. But there's a great big movement behind it. So let me introduce my guest properly. And she is Suzanne Kelly, PhD. She's an independent scholar whose work spans the topics of the environment, feminism, sex, and death. And she writes and farms in New York's Hudson Valley. Suzanne Kelly, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I have to admit, when I first saw this come through, I thought, well, you know, are we not already doing that? But having looked at your book, I see we're not being too concerned about the environment with the way that we handle things at the end of life. But first of all, I want to just get a little bit more history about how you got into this, because it's quite fascinating. I mean, you talk about feminism, sex, and death. How did you get interested in all of this?
Yeah, well, it was about 15 years ago now, in 2000. My father died quite suddenly, and it wasn't as though I hadn't been exposed to death before. I grew up in a fairly large extended Catholic family and had been going to wakes and funerals really since before I could remember. But I was also at that very time, really immersed in my new PhD studies, where I was looking at environmental theories and philosophies and feminist theories and philosophies of the body and the natural world, thinking about them as both playground and dump, and really sort of for the first time, these questions started to shift to the dead body. What do we think about the dead body? What do we do with the dead body in the U.S., and ultimately why? And that, of course, brought me to, of course, these really unsustainable and polluting standard American practices that we have kind of built up over the last 150 years, and excavating those, and really start really wanting to not only better understand the history, but to do something and to join with others, really, to change them. And I was really happy to find out in 2000 there was a bit of a glimmer of that happening around the U.S. There were some people who were beginning to think about creating more sustainable and less polluting death care practices.
Right, so let's look at, you found an interesting story about how burial started to change for us, really. But you go back as far as the Civil War and talk about the history of burial, because, you know, where I come from, it was a whole different process because the country was around a lot longer. But let's talk about, in America, how this process started and how it evolved.
Yeah, so, you know, over 150 years ago, we buried our dead in dust-to-dust ways, but it actually, the change started to happen actually prior to the Civil War, and in and around the 1830s, a new rise in urban populations collided with new fears around sanitation, and so this was at a time when there were diseases spreading like wildfire throughout these new emerging cities, and people were dying of things like cholera and yellow fever, and reformers were trying to figure out, you know, how to stop the disease from spreading. And so their sights sort of fell upon places of filth, you know, like human waste and garbage, and ultimately graveyards. Graveyards at that time were all within city and village limits. They were mostly church graveyards, where people were either buried there or they were buried out, you know, on the farm. And these were not places that really the living spent a lot of time in. They were kind of messy places, not well kept, sometimes even stinky places. And this is at a time when it was not really understood how diseases got into the body. It was believed at that time that actually if something smelled bad, this was called the miasma theory, it could actually kill you. It could cause you to get sick. Mm-hmm. So it really started then. So there was sort of this, what built up was kind of this erroneous fear that sent the dead sort of out into the outskirts of town, cities and villages started to place bans on burying the dead within village and city limits. Even in my small town, that happened by the 1850s. And these new cemeteries were built on the outskirts of town to what were called rural cemeteries in the U.S. to accommodate this problem, this potential wrath of the corpse. And this prevailing fear really has never left us, even though, as we know, dead bodies really generally do not pose a threat to public health. And yet there is this kind of prevailing social belief that endures. Now, as you said, the other big part of this history is the Civil War, and we saw, you know, there were so many dead, so many soldiers dying so far from home, you know, dying in the South who lived in the North.
Right, right.
And how do you get these bodies back for burial? Well, at that time, even though embalming had been around for thousands of years, it had been, never been done in the U.S., and it really was seen as sort of a fate worse than death. But there were new anatomists that were on the scene who were embalming bodies for study, and so they were called upon by the Union Army to come to the battlefield for those families who could afford it to send bodies back home. And, you know, the big part about this is that I think that we would think that since it was seen as sort of a fate worse than death prior to the war, that it would sort of wither away when the war ended. But in fact, it only built steam, and there were two reasons for this. One was that Abraham Lincoln's body, after he died, was embalmed. And it was embalmed and re-embalmed and sort of traveled across the country so that Americans could gaze upon it. And some historians have pointed to this as kind of representative of an overcoming of a war that had parted a nation. But it also gave them the ability to see this new practice of preservation for themselves. So that was one thing. And then the other thing was that the chemical companies that created the embalming fluids started to set up training, schools, workshops. These became our first mortuary schools. And so people eventually became trained in the practice, licensed in the practice, and the embalmer essentially became, you know, our first morticians.
Mm. So let's look at what we're doing today and how that's harmful to the environment, and have a few questions around this. First of all, why do we continue to embalm today?
Yeah, it's a really good question. You know, there are no laws that require embalming, and so why people embalm really has to do with the funeral industry that essentially pushes the practice. And for some,
is it partly religious though too, for some people?
You know, it's not tied to any specific religious practice. We know that Jews and Muslims do not embalm, and it's actually part of their burial law to not embalm. But there's no Christian doctrine that says, you know, that embalming is required. So embalming is really an industry practice that has been taken up by communities, and largely apart from Jews and Muslims, you know, has become basically at this point now, because cremation rates are so high, you know, definitely 50% or more of the practice. But it's not specifically tied to religious practice.
And so how is that harmful to our environment?
Yeah, so embalming fluid is actually made up of a chemical of formaldehyde, right, which we know is a known carcinogen. And while it is biodegradable, which means that it does break down when it comes in contact with soil, water, and air, it is a known carcinogen, which means that it really poses a threat to worker health. So it does, you know, the embalmer is at risk every time they use embalming fluid. So that's the one thing with embalming. The other two parts of the polluting practices really have to do with the use of sealed hardwood and metal caskets and the use of burial vaults, which are most often made out of reinforced concrete, but they're also sometimes made out of plastic, and they're also sometimes made out of asphalt, which we know is a semi-solid form of petroleum. And for people who aren't aware of it, most cemeteries, and again, there are no laws that require this, but most cemeteries require a burial vault. This is a vault that's placed into the ground, and then the casket is placed inside that, primarily to counteract the reality of subsidence. If you put a coffin into the ground without a burial vault, eventually the body is going to decay and the container is going to decay. And unless you mound it up and you don't create turf there, there'll be a kind of divot in the ground. And because our cemeteries are so highly managed and manicured and we have lawnmowers running through them, we would have divots everywhere. So that's why they require the burial vaults.
So look, I mean, I've staggered at these numbers here. Every year, 20 million board feet of hardwood, 64,000 tons of steel are buried in the form of caskets and grave lining vaults. You talked about formaldehyde just a few minutes ago. 4.3 million gallons of embalming fluid are used every year, which end up ultimately in the ground. So there's quite a lot of stuff going on there that we just don't think about.
Yeah.
I read that cremation, you know, I think many people think cremation is the kind of way to go for the environment, but you say that's not necessarily true.
Well, I think that the Green Burial Movement, and again, you know, this is a movement that's been happening across the U.S. I think if we look at the opening of the first Green Burial Ground as 1998, we're talking about over 15 years now where people have been waking up to these polluting practices and thinking about greener ways. But I think that the movement, by and large, sees cremation as the second most environmentally sound way of disposing of the dead. And if it's less than ideal, that's because anytime you burn something, you pose a threat to soil, water, and air. In parts of Europe, they've done a much better job at placing filters on crematories to filter out byproducts like furans and dioxins and even mercury from dental fillings, and also finding more energy-efficient ways to fuel their crematories. But in the U.S., we really have a long way to go.
Okay, so let's look at what we could and should maybe be doing for our environment. What are the top couple of tips there?
Well, you know, I think if we look at the green burial grounds that have been emerging around the U.S., and if people are interested in seeing where they are in the U.S., there's a good list at the Green Burial Council website where there are they certify green burial grounds in the U.S., so many of them are on their website if they're certified. But at those green burial grounds, and they do differ in terms of their goals, but overall, green burial at its most basic includes whole body earth burial without the use of chemical embalming fluid and without the use of a hardwood or metal casket and without the use of a burial vault. So it basically means going into the ground in some kind of biodegradable container, whether it's a pine box or a shroud or a blanket or a wicker container. There's many options that people can choose from, but these are some of the most popular ones.
Okay. And so when we're looking at cremation, is there a kind of way of doing that? Not everybody will want to go in a box.
Yeah, exactly. You mean in terms of making it greener?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, in terms of the burial grounds, I think that one of the ways that we know that the Green Burial Movement is embracing cremation is that most of the Green Burial Grounds, if not all of them, accept interment and or scattering of cremated remains. But like I said, I think that, you know, that our crematories have to do a better job of creating better filters and to filter out some of these byproducts, as well as coming up with better ways to fuel our crematories. So I think looking to what's happening in parts of Europe is really the best that we can do for the practice of cremation in the U.S., because it's estimated that by 2030 will be nationwide as high as about 70% of all disposition will be cremation.
Okay. So as somebody who's concerned about this, and you obviously are, you've written a whole book on this, and by the way, it's beautifully written. It's very narrative. It's
Thank
not
you.
At all what I was expecting when I read this. And we should say it's called Greening Death, Reclaiming Burial Practices and Restoring Our Tie to the Earth. But as somebody who's very concerned about this, what is it you are trying to get us, the public at large, if you will, who are not familiar with all of this, to change in our thinking?
Well, you know, I think that what's interesting when you look at the movement is that, like my experience where I sort of woke up to these practices, you know, about 15 years ago, the polluting ones and the potential of kind of reclaiming old practices in a new way, in a new age, is that people around the U.S. are doing this. This is a grassroots movement. This is not a movement that is coming out from the industry. It's actually a movement that's coming from the people in communities large and small. And so in many ways, I think it's what we're seeing is that what we're witnessing really is a reclaiming of lost knowledges of the way that we used to care for our dead. You know, when the funeral industry kind of built up steam starting in the mid-1800s, and then we've been living with this funeral industry, it sort of left these knowledges in its wake, but they haven't gone away for good. So I think on the one hand, one of the things that I'm trying to point out in the book is that people are waking up to these practices, but they're reclaiming lost knowledges in a new way. So that's part of the struggle. The other part of it is that I think environmentalists have been telling us for a long time, people like Aldo Leopold and Rachel Carson and even Vandana Shiva today, that if we are ever to really heal this broken earth, you know, put out this fire that is our planet right now, we need to find ways to see ourselves in relationship to the planet, to nature, to the earth. And green burial practices really are one more way that we really can begin to do that. So that's, in fact, what I say. Sort of, I point to throughout the book in each and every chapter that is its really greatest potential.
Right, right. And of course, we're so multicultural today, and there are such cultural intricacies in all of this, you know, sensitivities, if you will, around this process that in order for us to sustain this, we've all really got to come together on this.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, one of the, I think the greatest one of the other greatest potentials of the Green Burial Movement that we're witnessing, as I said, is this is a grassroots movement. This is a movement that's coming out of communities large and small. And so it's not as though, this is not a top-down movement where it's like, okay, where if it was a funeral industry movement, you know, we would say, okay, here's the practices, and now we'll lay them over in individual cultures and contexts and communities. So it's interesting to watch and see as it's unfolding how particular communities, especially in terms of race and class, are making sense of these practices in terms of their own rituals, in terms of their own past, in terms of their own context. So yeah, I would agree.
Mm. So, I used to, when I was a child, I used to watch these, my mother's Kirk Douglas movies. And I always thought it was the most wonderful practice when a Viking was killed and he was put on his ship and it was...
Me too.
It was set afire until I read a National Geographic special not too many years ago, actually, where they said that all of his wives who were alive were also put on his ship.
Oh, God, I didn't know that.
And burned with him. I was like, okay, forget that for a game.
Wow.
So
okay,
So tell us what else you're working on as far as this. I mean, do you do outreach programs?
Yeah, well, the other piece of this for me is that, you know, when I was initially waking up to these practices, my greatest desire was to connect with others who wanted to change these practices too, but and also a lot of that for me meant creating a green burial ground in my neck of the woods. And so I moved back to the community I grew up in back in 2002, and really over the next 10 years was trying to connect with folks within about a 100-mile radius to build a natural burial ground in my community. It's not so easy, depending upon the type that you want to sort of construct. And eventually, what came to be was that our town cemetery. I live in a town called Rhinebeck, New York. There were people in the community who were really interested in green burial, and they went to the town. And they said, you know, can we start looking into this? And so I ended up becoming the chair of the town cemetery committee, and we came up as a committee for a plan for a green burial ground in our town, and it was just finally after about 5 years of work open last year. So I do give talks locally, and then I do a lot of outreach in terms of education, but putting together that burial ground has been most rewarding.
Yeah. Well, good for you, and thanks for sharing insights here that I had no idea about. It's quite amazing that, you know, stuff we take for granted because it's just what everybody does and you don't realize what kind of impact it's having.
Yeah.
Well, the book is called Greening Death, Reclaiming Burial Practices and Restoring Our Tie to the Earth. Suzanne Kelly, PhD, is the author. A website where people can find you, Suzanne?
Yeah, SuzanneMKelly.com.
Super. Thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
And please do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Coming up November 16th on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Catherine Kemp Goulet shares her recipes for increased energy and a more vibrant life in Mountain Montrose, wellness and life lessons from the slopes. Join us every Monday at noon right here on Alternative Talk 1150 AM and listen to archive shows at conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair with Conversations Live. If you'd like to gain more exposure for your business, service, or event, or if you'd like to raise awareness for an issue or topic you're passionate about, call me. Let's talk about ways we might partner to shine the spotlight on you and bring you the recognition you deserve. Call me at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
You listen when your body says, I'm tired. Or, I'm hungry. Are you listening? Would you listen if your body said, I have pain and pressure in my abdomen. I feel bloated for no good reason. Or I get too full too fast. I'm spotting, but I've already gone through menopause. Or I have to go to the bathroom more often and more urgently than usual. These can be signs of a gynecologic cancer, like cervical, ovarian, uterine, vaginal, and vulvar cancers. Symptoms aren't the same for everyone. If your body says something may be wrong, please listen, learn the symptoms, and get the inside knowledge about gynecologic cancers. Call 1-800-CDC-INFO. A message from the Inside Knowledge Campaign and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Talk radio with a difference. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And I'm going to just fess up here. We're having one of those days. We're having difficulty getting. We've got three guests scheduled. And even though everything was confirmed and confirmed and confirmed, we've just been running into some technical issues getting hold of them one way or another. Steve McClatchy is my next guest. And I know that we will have him on the air in just a moment here. But he's written a great book. You know, if ever you felt burnout, you know, that horrible feeling where you just don't feel like yourself, you just can't get, you know, every day it's a struggle to get through the day. You feel like you can't cope with one more thing. And, you know, there's just, you feel like you're stuck on this treadmill just going, you know, work, eat, sleep, work, eat, sleep, work, eat, sleep. We all get there at times, and it can be very, very difficult to pull yourself back from that. And it's like, how do you do it when you're already so tired and so burned out? How do you find the energy to pull yourself back? Well, Steve McClatchy has written a great book. It's called Decide. It's called Work Smarter, Reduce Your Stress, and Lead by Example. It's a New York Times bestseller. It is kind of it's not really focused around business, but he does a lot of business consulting. And it really does, it applies to every aspect of your life, to your personal life, to relationships, to work, to family relationships. And so I was really thrilled to read this weekend because I'd been making some changes. You know, I think periodically everybody has to kind of step back and regroup and say, okay, is this where I'm meant to be heading? Do I need to go in a new direction? Do I need to change things? And I've kind of been doing that over the last, I don't know, 6 or 7 months. Made some really great changes I'm really happy with. And I felt that there was a little bit missing. And when I read his book, it kind of came to me that, okay, this is what I was missing. And he's going to talk to us about that in a moment. He says that every decision we make comes from one of two motivating factors. And I've lost my notes here. Sorry about this. Hold on one second. I've got too many pieces of paper. We've had to switch from one guest to the other depending on who we could get hold of today. But he talks about how every decision we make comes from looking for gain or trying to prevent pain. And so that's what we're going to be talking about here. But he really gives some great tips about how to get out of that situation when you're feeling utterly burned out. And like I said, it really hit me where it needed to hit me, which was in the tush this week. Let me tell you a little bit about Steve. He's an international speaker, trainer, consultant, writer, and entrepreneur. He's founded the Alia Training and Consulting Company out of his passion for continual improvement and his belief that when we stop growing, learning, gaining experience, achieving goals, and improving, we stop living. And I would agree with that. He's worked in sales management, training, and consulting for organizations such as the Pillsbury Company, Broaderband Software, and Forte Systems. And I do believe we have him on the phone right now. Eric? Yes, thumbs up. Steve, welcome.
Hey, Vicky, thanks for having me.
So pleased we could connect with you. Apologies for the kerfuffle at the beginning of the show here.
No worries.
I just had to fess up to listeners here. There's no getting around it today. It's one of those things. You got to come clean. But I already introduced you. I've just told them a little bit about the book. And I want to begin with What many psychologists agree on, and that's there's just two forms of human motivation. Talk to us about those, if you would.
Yeah, so what gets us up out of our seat, right, is basically two things: to gain something, to gain a benefit, to gain an outcome or a result, something we desire, or to prevent the consequences we don't want to face, like taking out the trash. You know, nobody likes to take out the trash, but we all do it. What's our motivation? We think of the consequences we would face if we didn't do it. So really, every task, every decision we make, every time we get motivated, it's to prevent consequences or to go towards benefits.
Okay. And so that applies to every aspect of our life. You say we're often motivated by both, but one is always the driving motivation factor.
Yeah, and that was a key insight. And when gain and the benefits that you're going after is the majority of the motivation, these tasks, activities, and decisions produce significantly greater results for us than the prevent pain-driven tasks.
Okay. And so gain is focusing on something we want, we desire, and which leads us to more focus, more direction.
And more balance.
And more balance.
You know, that feeling of balance seems to be such a mystery today. And, you know, you'll read all about it. It's kind of a hot topic these days, burnout and balance. And balance is a feeling you get when you get excited. And burnout is a feeling that we seem to get when we spend too much time with the tasks that help us to maintain our lives. You know, those tasks have deadlines and urgency, and they repeat over and over again, and we just prevent consequences by doing them, but we don't get any benefits. We don't move forward when we do them.
Okay. And so when we look at preventing pain, we're focusing things that we have to do. So let's talk about what some of those might look like, because, you know, people might not put the categories that you talked about into that preventing pain box.
Yeah, so, those tasks that taking out the trash, doing the laundry, paying the bills, commuting to work, answering email, those tasks that have deadlines, they repeat over and over again, and they really just have consequences if we don't do them. But when you do them, you really don't feel like you get any benefits at all. But those gain tasks, like running a marathon, taking a class, getting an MBA, learning a musical instrument or a new language, these are things that we remember our entire lives that we did. I mean, the results are so significant, we remember them a year, 5 years, a decade, maybe even a lifetime. And then there's tasks we don't remember 5 minutes after we do them.
Mm-hmm. And so basically, you broke it down in the book to say that if we're managing our lives, which many people say, I'm my own life manager, I'm managing my life. But if we're managing our lives, we're just maintaining. And what should we be doing?
And you should be doing both. It's kind of, you know, as soon as the brain hears the concept of, you know, the maintenance tasks versus the improvement tasks, we typically pit them against each other. And my approach and what I write about in Decide is that we can do both. We can take care of all the maintenance items and have a date night with our spouse or, set or achieve a goal or write a book like I did. These are things you can do in parallel with maintenance. We always put one against the other. And if you do, maintenance will always win because there's always a maintenance activity to do. So the process to move your life forward for progress, for advancement, is really to schedule it, to defend it when it comes under attack from maintenance, and then you're going to play catch up with maintenance after you do it. But that maintenance is easier to catch up on after you accomplish something. After when you move your life forward, you get endorphins. And endorphins contain painkillers. Endorphins come from a sense of accomplishment. And those endorphins make playing catch up with the maintenance easier. So it's not that some people have time for goals and other people don't. None of us have time for goals. So we have to do what we call make time. And I hate that expression, make time, because there's 24 hours in a day no matter who you are. But making time means I'm willing to fall behind on maintenance because of it. Okay. And you'll see people point to maintenance as the reason they can't do. Oh, I'd love to do that. I'd love to accomplish that. I can't because I have to. And they point to a maintenance item. And you can always do that. What you're saying is it's not worth falling behind on maintenance.
Right. And you do talk a lot in the book about, and I've only actually, for the purposes of our little short conversation here, we're only looking at the first two chapters of the book. But there's so much great information in there. You say that one of the reasons we feel this horrible burnout is because we don't have that sense of accomplishment. And we get our sense of self-identity from the goals that we're achieving. Well, of course, if we're not achieving them, we're losing out there.
Yeah, your brain has a question for you with every task you complete. Are you doing this because you have to do it, or are you doing this because you want to do it? And when we are in 1-2 mode, see, we're all doing the maintenance task. That makes us look the same, right? We don't get identity from them because we all do the same maintenance task. What separates us from everyone else are the things that we do in life that we don't have to do, the things that we want to do, the things that move us forward. So that's where I go in the direction of it builds our self-worth, our self-esteem, and our self-identity when we do these things that we desire versus doing the things that we just have to do.
Right, right. And so let's look at, we just talked about balance. And when people are thinking, I work with so many companies who don't even use that word anymore. They don't use that work-life balance.
Oh, Vicky, I've had companies ask me to leave it out. They're like, hey, don't talk about balance. We don't have it around here. And I was like, wow.
Yeah, and some of them changed it to work-life satisfaction. But my philosophy on balance has always been, as long as you feel good about it, you're not out of balance. But once you start feeling off-kilter, then that's when you need to go look at what you're doing. And you talk about consumption versus creation goals. I wonder if you'd break those down for us.
Yeah, that's a really key insight that I think captures a big opportunity for being a productive person. So consumption goals are things like a vacation, a concert, something you get excited about before you do it. And that could be a goal, right, to go on a vacation this year. But you get excited before you do it. Creation goals are things you get excited after you do them. Things like getting an MBA, writing a book. These aren't things you look forward to before you do it.
Right,
when you start
right.
writing the book, you think of the last chapter. So if you can use those two energy sources against each other, one gets you excited before you do it. So often what I do is when I schedule something that's going to be very difficult to create, I put a consumption goal, something to celebrate, a reward at the end of it. So then I'm excited about the reward, and that gives me energy to do the creation goal. So very interesting play on how we accomplish and how go-getters really accomplish great things, because it's exhausting creating all of this stuff. So you have to reward yourself and celebrate, and that makes a lot of sense to your brain that it's worth all the work.
Right, right. So it sounds like, just talking very quickly, like we're creating more work for ourselves here, but we're not. And I really want to stress that because, you know, I really got the light bulb because I have the advantage of reading the book. And we're covering this very quickly here. But by inserting gain goals into our life, you know, even if they're tiny little things, that sense of accomplishment is what helps to restore our balance, right?
That's it. That I love what you said about, you know, do you resent the work you're doing? Are you excited about it? You could work for 2 straight days with no sleep and feel balanced. I just have one question. What were you doing for 2 straight days with no sleep? If you were doing something you wanted to do that you were excited about, you feel balanced. Balance is a feeling we get when we have the maintenance in our lives being taken care of, but we're moving forward and we're excited about the direction we're going. And when that excitement is there, I remember when I wrote just the first chapter of the book, I'd stayed up all night doing it. But boy, I felt fantastic, and I was so confused because I was out of balance by everything that's ever been written about the topic of balance. But I had the feeling. I was excited, and excitement comes from decisions we make. And it's really different for each and every person. So the true feeling of balance, the first step is to identify. What's going to get me excited? Where do I need to go? I mean, burnout is really a point of opportunity for all of us. It's a feeling we get that says, you're ready to move from where you are now. And not just physically, right? It's time for advancement. It's time for growth. It's time for movement in your life again. It's time to set a goal, learn something new, acquire a new skill, gain a new experience. It's time. And if you act on it, it can be a great opportunity for you in your life.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that sense of frustration and burnout, and when you feel that stuck in the rut, there's your opportunity to do something really different. I know we have to let you go. I wish we could talk longer. I really enjoyed the book. It's called Decide, Work Smarter, Reduce Your Stress, and Lead by Example. And this covers all aspects of your life, as I said in the intro. Where can listeners find out more about you, Steve?
So my website is a great resource. It's allere.com, ALLEER.com. They can also follow me on Twitter. I get great compliments about my Twitter. It's at Steve McClatchy.
Thank you, Steve McClatchy. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks, Vicky. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate it. We're going to take a very quick break, and then we'll bring back our next guest. You're listening to Conversations Live.
Let's see if I guess that... This just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Heaven and Earth Chinese Herbs, we cover the world of animals. This week, November 15th, it's Vet Sunday, and we'll have both Dr. Bill Burlingame and Dr. Doug Year out in the studio. The best balanced approach and expert immune support with Dr. Bill, and the best alternative medicine and expert homeopathy for all animals with Dr. Doug. Take advantage and get free advice from two of the best. Give us a call on Martha Norwalk's Animal World Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
You listen when your body says, I'm tired, or I'm hungry. Are you listening? Would you listen if your body said, I have pain and pressure in my abdomen. I feel bloated for no good reason. Or, I get too full too fast. I'm spotting, but I've already gone through menopause. Or, I have to go to the bathroom more often and more urgently than usual. These can be signs of a gynecologic cancer, like cervical, ovarian, uterine, vaginal, and vulvar cancers. Symptoms aren't the same for everyone. If your body says something may be wrong, please listen, learn the symptoms, and get the inside knowledge about gynecologic cancers. Call 1-800-CDC-INFO. A message from the Inside Knowledge Campaign and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Coming up November 16th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Catherine Kemp Goulet shares her recipes for increased energy and a more vibrant life in Mountain Montrose, wellness and life lessons from the slopes. Join us every Monday at noon right here on Alternative Talk 1150 AM and listen to archive shows at conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Get current weather, traffic, and news. Visit 1150kknw.com and stay informed with Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everybody. We are going to talk now about something that affects many, many people in the workplace. It's a very serious situation. It gets very little media attention, yet verbal, psychological, physical, cyber, and sexual bullying go on in the workplace. According to my guest, at the expense of $1.5 trillion drain on the North American economy, it says that 95% of people bullied at work have PTSD, a staggering 80% of people at large feel they work in an unhelpful or hostile environment, and around 120 deaths a year may be attributable to workplace stress. And joining me today, I have Andrew Fass. He's the founder of the Fass Foundation. We'll find out more about this. Let me bring him on. And welcome, Andrew, to the show today.
Thanks, Vicki. I'm a pleasure to be on it with you.
And so this is an interesting topic, and I know that you had firsthand experience in this. So tell us a little bit about what happened to you. I know very early on in your career, you know, your boss had said to you, watch how you handle people. But then later on in your Korea, you felt the other end of things. So talk to us a little bit about those situations.
Sure. I think I offer a fairly unique perspective in so much that I was called out for being a bully early in my career. And throughout my career, I have been involved with a number of bullying situations as someone who has helped people through it, who's been a witness, defender, resister of bullying, created psychologically safe workplaces where bullying is just not tolerated. And later in my career, I was retaliated against for blowing the whistle on a corrupt executive. So I've pretty much seen the full gamut on both the impact, the ways and means of bullying, and now what to do to prevent it.
And so what, I know you went through a lot when you were in a bullied situation. You lost around 30 pounds, you said, which you couldn't afford to do. You ended up with what many people who are bullied in the workplace end up with, which is PTSD. So let's just define what...
Now, just for clarification, I had symptoms consistent with post-traumatic stress disorder. I was never diagnosed unless you consider self-diagnosis.
Right.
But I definitely had the symptoms consistent with it, and my research has found that people who are severely bullied suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's a horrible, horrible experience that really propelled me to shift what was totally absorbed all of my thinking time, and it was such negative energy that I needed to find closure. And you know, even well after the bullying stopped, which by the way is something that people who are bullied, it leaves a scar, and it's very, very difficult to just forget about it because it is so all-consuming.
Yeah. Now, I know you talk with a lot of CEOs, and they tend to believe it doesn't happen in their workplace. I mean, you know, I just think right now, recently we had the New York Times articles about some managers at Amazon, and the way things were handled there. And, of course, that was news to Jeff Bezos, so he says. But it definitely does go on. So give me some examples of what you've experienced, what you've come across when you're talking with people.
I'll talk about the common things that that people who are targeted go through. First and foremost, the bullying has gone on for a period of time before the person even realizes that they are being targeted and bullied. And when it does come to their attention or it dawns on them and they talk to people about it, people basically say to them, listen, suck it up. You know, that's just the way it is.
Right.
And by that time, you know, the harm has already been being done. And what I found in most cases is that the person that is targeted becomes the villain, and they're labeled as a disgruntled, poor performer with a bad attitude. And yes, they are. And the reason they are is because of what they're going through or had gone through in being harassed or bullied by someone in the organization, usually their boss.
Right. Now, if it's your boss bullying you and you go around them, that may cause even bigger problems. So let's look at...
That, by the way, is the kiss of death.
Yes. Okay, so let's look at how we should handle these, because, you know, you just say that many companies actually condone this in their practices that they uphold. So let's look at how we can deal with it if we feel we're being bullied. And in fact, you say many people don't even realize they're being bullied.
That until it's too late.
Yeah.
That's correct. And it's usually rationalized, well, that's just that person's style. That's not their intention. reminded of the stigma of coming forward by saying, you know, that you may not be tough enough to work in this environment. The most recent example, quite frankly, is the best example in the expose that Amazon wrote. And there's a book out, came out a couple of years ago. It's called The Everything Store, and it talks about how Amazon evolved. But that culture, if 25% of what the article cites is true, then they've got a serious, serious situation on their hands. And Bezos' reaction to it, well, that's not the Amazon I know, is at best a deflection.
Yeah.
Because from what I read from the book and then reading the article, it, you know, there's no way that this was not a well-planned-out a model that was developed to exploit people. There's no kinder way to say that, and unfortunately, he and other top executives are getting rewarded for it because the stock keeps climbing, notwithstanding the huge risk that they face, and that is at some point they will not be able to find employees to work for them.
Yeah. Well, they're not the only ones, though, because I did a very quick Google search will show many, many companies have been set up this way to, if you will, manage by intimidation, which, you know, fosters this atmosphere. But I've also found myself personally working as a consultant with many large companies. It very much depends on what group you are in. Some groups are fabulous and other groups, thanks, but once my contract's done, I'm out of here.
Exactly.
You know, so, but for somebody who's dealing with this on a daily basis, it is not fun and it can cause very serious psychological and even physical harm to them. So let's assume that your boss is the one who's doing the bullying. How do we handle this situation, Andrew?
Well, the advice I give to people when they're faced with a situation, and now I'm getting a lot of people approaching me from the book and then the blog and talks I give on the topic. And the one piece of advice I give everybody is not to deal with it alone. And that it is okay to confront it, but be careful on how you confront it. And be factual relative to what you're confronting on. And what I also say to people, unless you absolutely trust people in human resources, they are the wrong people to go to.
Yeah.
Because unfortunately, in 80% of the cases, people in human resources are seen as part of the problem versus part of the solution.
Yeah, I've seen that myself where, you know, HR, their job really is to support the CEO, even though they say it's not.
Well, that's exactly right. And you know, and if they came out with it and said, well, this is our role, then that's fair ball.
Yeah.
But if they're portrayed as being the neutral party here, acting as a in between, then they're misrepresenting why they're there.
Mm-hmm.
And I firmly believe, by the way, that they can be part of the solution, and they should be part of the solution, and they are, in essence, the custodian of the culture of the organization and the values it stands for, and the same way the chief financial officer is responsible for the integrity of the financial statements.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a role that they should be playing, and if they played it, we would see a lot different scenarios out there.
So looking at it from the other perspective, if you're a supervisor and somebody comes up to you, a manager, leader, whatever, somebody comes up to you and says, I'm being bullied, you know, we do live in this hypersensitive culture where nobody wants to take responsibility for anything, especially their own personal actions, it seems. And so it's easy for people to pull the bully card when, you know, when they're told something they simply don't like.
Well, that's,
how do we determine the difference?
That's a pushback I get quite often. And the reality is that very few people who are being bullied actually come forward.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some that, yes, you'd use it as a shield or a sword.
And why is it they don't come forward? I mean, it's fear of retribution.
The stigma associated with it. They, in most cases, feel that they're the only ones that are going through this. They blame themselves. Maybe they did something wrong, and they go through this whole emotional trauma that in a society that believes it is weak to show it's weak to show weakness.
Well, this was an interesting side here that I read on the in a newspaper, online news magazine. Employers in Australia, it said, may be scrambling to update their social media and anti-bullying policies in light of a finding by their Fair Work Commission, the Australia Fair Work Commission, that Facebook unfriending may constitute workplace bullying.
Well, you know, that's taking in my book I talk about making distinctions in terms of what is bullying and what is not bullying.
Mm-hmm.
And to get back to the earlier point, managers, you know, who are faced with the threat of being called a bully, claim that they are afraid to correct deficiencies or set aggressive expectations, hold people accountable, and those things are not bullying.
Okay.
Where they become bullying is where there is an effort to destroy, not to correct.
Okay, very and very significant difference there.
A huge difference, and I'll, you know, use the to illustrate it.
We've only got 30 seconds here, so.
Okay, so the best example is boot camps. Is boot camps bullying? And my answer to that is no. You cannot send people in harm's way without testing them for strength and endurance. When it becomes aggression to destroy, abuse to destroy, it becomes bullying.
Okay.
And that's where I think the distinction really comes in.
Well, Andrew Fass, thank you so much for being with us today. The book is called The Bully's Trap. Andrew's website is called thebullystrap.com. And you can find out more about that and the blog and reviews, etc., at thebullystrap.com. Andrew Fass, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
All right, so we survived today. It was a little hectic trying to find all of our guests today, but I thank you for hanging in with us, and we will be back next week with an all-live new show, and that's going to go really smoothly, so... Be with us. You can find me at Facebook, Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. You can find me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair. And if you have feedback or questions, comments on today's show, you can reach me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617, or info@conversationslive.net. Live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation. at nwpf.org.
You listen when your body says, I'm tired, or I'm hungry. What if your body said something else might be wrong? Gynecologic cancers, cervical, ovarian, and uterine cancers have symptoms, so pay attention. If your body says something may be wrong, please listen. Learn the symptoms. Get the inside knowledge about gynecologic cancers. A message from HHS and CDC's Inside Knowledge Campaign.